Good evening and welcome to Slam the Gavel, the show that tells it all regarding family court, other court issues, as well as CPS. I am your host, Marianne Petrie. This episode of Slam the Gavel is sponsored by CPS Protect Consulting Services. Child Protective Services cases are among the most frightening experiences any parent can endure. Don't face them alone. With urgent assist by CPS Protect, you get the peace of mind to raise your children as you see fit. The personalized assistance of their team of expert child welfare consultants, former CPS investigators themselves, right when you need it. Get started absolutely free at cpsprotect.com/register. Also, go to the site pleasedoyourjob.com. We need 2,000 more signatures to get a case reopened. Please go to the site pleasedoyourjob.com. I have a brand new guest on. I have Dr. Robert Boschwitz on. He's a consultant in evidentiary audit and a university lecturer in biology. He has a long background as a scientist handling data and evaluating evidence. In addition, he has been trained and certified as a fraud examiner. He has also been the plaintiff relator in a federal False Claims Act science fraud case and has personally experienced a serious misconduct that seems to run rampant in the U.S. family courts today. One of the most important things Dr. Boschwitz learned in the graduate school was that science was not always an ivory tower of discipline and conducted by people devoted to the integrity or the data they were producing. Instead, it was a business conducted by people who were overly self-centered and very willing to cheat to survive and make money. That experience eventually led to him to work with the federal government to try to recover grant funds, which had been obtained under false pretenses based on fabricated and falsified data submitted by scientists at Cornell University and Thomas Jefferson University. During the federal case, Dr. Boschwitz began his training as a fraud investigator, and just after the case, he also obtained training as a paralegal specializing in litigation. Most importantly, his experience with science fraud case led him in 2011 to start his own fraud investigation firm, Amirandus Research. It was initially geared toward helping whistleblowers and their attorneys investigate their legal cases and keep their communication secure. But as time went on, he found that providing career rehabilitation services was also very important to whistleblowers. Although Dr. Boschwitz never envisioned ending up in family court, it was through his more recent experience in that arena that he feels himself being transformed into a whistleblower again, or at least one of the many tens of thousands of potential whistleblowers like himself. He is on the show today to tell us a little bit about his experience in family court, his journey, and what he and others are trying to do to improve the widely appreciated problems that are just in these courts. And I welcome you, Dr. Boschwitz. How are you? And what do you think of all this?
Well, thanks, Marianne. It's great to be here to discuss the crisis in our courts that so severely affects so many individual Americans. I've listened to your podcast for some time now, as you know, and it reinforces just how widespread the problems with the family courts are and how common and similar the complaints can be. We were discussing that just before you started. Despite so many Americans suffering what they believe to be serious injustices in what are supposed to be courts of justice, the system itself doesn't make any serious or effective attempt to gather comprehensive complaint data. The courts apparently believe that they do not need to look for problems with their performance since they're allowed to self-regulate. There's no independent quality control. My journey through family court has suffered from many of the same types of egregious misconduct as we have heard from so many of your prior guests and yourself included. Since I believe that the details do matter, I've created a Slam the Gavel show links menu that document can be found in the link which should be associated with this podcast and YouTube video.
Okay.
The menu document not only links to court filings that I'll mention today, but it also provides some excerpts from those documents. The excerpt should make it easier for interested readers to get an introduction to what's in the linked case filings. Now, as you mentioned, I'm a strong believer in the importance and centrality of evidence. That's no surprise, given my background as a scientist. Mm-hmm. The courts, in contrast, grant themselves what they term discretion, and for the people who are just listening, my air quotes are going, which they believe allows them in some insufficiently defined way to decide what evidence they do and do not want to acknowledge. You know, if there's a problem with the way a judge is ignoring or otherwise excluding evidence, the litigant's forced to appeal. The appellate courts that I've experienced, specifically the Federal United States Courts of Appeal for the Third Circuit, which covers Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and also the Pennsylvania State Appellate Courts, seem to me by far more interested in backing up their colleagues than in overseeing or correcting them. I'll describe some of the issues that I faced in my court experiences. As you mentioned, my legal odyssey started in federal court as a plaintiff scientist acting on behalf of the government. That's what a relator is. But amazingly, that case was later brought into a family court action in Pennsylvania in an effort to impeach my credibility. So that's probably a little more unusual than some of your speakers have had before happen. So what was initially a federal whistleblower case later got drawn into a family law case. That was a really eye-opening event. It definitively showed that court opinions published online, which, by the way, can stubbornly rank very high in a person's search engine results, can be used to harm former litigants. That became particularly important when the claims made in the published court opinion are false and defamatory. And I know lots of your speakers have complained about that. And you had one recently on. He did a good job of pointing out how damaging some of these opinions were, even when he eventually went on to have a court overturn or someone rules in your favor. They're still up there. And these online false claims don't only harm former litigants in subsequent legal proceedings. In the linked documents, I give the conclusion of a vocational expert on the impact of negative online statements on a person's employability. So I've put an affidavit in my links that I wrote about the various instances of what I believe were misconduct by the federal court judge in my case. That affidavit was provided to an attorney who was handling several other unrelated cases before the same federal judge. She wanted him removed from all of her cases, and I believe she succeeded. My attorneys, however, just got disgusted of having to deal with this judge, calling him things like, quote, a loose cannon and, quote, a piece of work. And I used to refer to him as the defense counsel in chief. He was so brazenly biased. Yeah, people are saying, yeah, probably nodding their heads. But despite the agreement that the judge was not behaving appropriately, my attorneys didn't act to remove him. Now, Federal False Claims Act cases like mine, that's what that whistleblowing case, a lot of them are brought under what's called the Federal False Claims Act. They're like mine. They're taken on contingency, which meant that my attorneys felt that they were the ones paying to be abused by the judge. So despite the Department of Justice's recommending that my attorneys appeal rulings of legal claims made by this judge, which is described in part in their amicus brief that you can find in the links, the attorneys did not appeal. So attorneys unwilling to stand up to aggressive, abusive judges is another theme in my court experiences. And I would not be surprised if many of your listeners have suffered this same problem. And that doesn't even begin to address the other court officers who abuse their powers as well. However, to look at the other side of the coin, briefly, one of my clients at Amarantis Research was himself an attorney. He had been quite prominent in Pennsylvania, and like the attorney to whom I gave the affidavit about my federal case that I just mentioned, this Pennsylvania attorney felt that some judges were always ruling against his clients, no matter what the merits of their cases were. So I investigated the claims of one of his clients and had concluded that the evidence likely supported what his client's concerns were about the court, including a clerk's office. Now, the Pennsylvania lawyer had repeatedly filed complaints about the judges handling his client's cases, particularly since his clients were very supportive of him, not just the one that I'd done work for. However, that only made matters worse. It becomes hard to maintain the law practice if you're seen as a blacklisted lawyer. I mean, lawyers try to sell wins to potential clients. You know, who wants to start with a lawyer that the judges do not like, right? So there are practical survival reasons for attorneys to go along with very aggressive judges rather than fight them. Judges can also cause a lot of problems by not being aggressive enough with dishonest attorneys. We've seen that too. So you can have both. You can have, I've been describing this federal judge who was just very aggressively dishonest himself, and the attorneys were not really pushing back, or at least mine weren't enough. And you have the opposite. You can have judges who are just going to let the attorneys run riot. So I wrote this in my appeals. I wrote, that about these frivolous and vexatious filings, which not only permit financial warfare against a weaker party, financially weaker party, but in the absence of any attempt by the court to enforce due diligence requirements on its officers, meaning those who are willing to fabricate baseless claims in their filings, it permits the operation of essentially a racket that can enrich all of the counsel to the detriment of the litigants. And so what I mean by racket here is that the racketeer is allowed to manufacture their own charges. If they can repeatedly file unsubstantiated claims in court, okay, then opposing counsel has to defend against those claims. Each counsel bills their client. So you can think of it as a two-way, as a type of two-way protection racket, right? Both of them. In fact, I have a college a roommate who went on to become an attorney. He said it's almost like they're playing tennis with each other. Okay, and he's an attorney. So it's a cooperative venture because everyone's making money, except at the detriment, obviously, of the client. So the poorer party usually has to give up or go pro se. I think in family court in the United States, some huge percentage. Yeah, right. Some huge percentage of what is it? 70, 80% end up.
It's like 78. I believe it could be higher,
It's
82%.
pushing 80%, right. I mean, everyone has their limits, but you can only go so bankrupt and be kind of feeling like you're hitting your head against the wall, running into a wall that before you decide, well, I'll just have to do it myself. And so too many of us have experienced that as well. So to me, the key is the judges failing to issue sanctions for attorneys who do not make an effort to ensure the credibility of what they file, or as is even more common, they knowingly lie. So interestingly, there is a Rule 11 of federal civil procedure that allows a party to request sanctions for such behavior. But I don't know, and I never found a comparable rule in Pennsylvania at the state level. It does appear in the professional rules of conduct, which tend to have no bearing, by the way, on the progress of a case. So there's more detail about this racketeering-like aspects of my family law case in the linked documents, if anyone wants to take a look at that. All that being said, no litigant that I've ever met wants to feel that their attorney is throwing them under the bus, and it seems to happen too far, far too often. So I think the way this stops is by cracking down on judges and other adjudicators like masters, so that their powers are far more limited, and importantly, that they're scrutinized by independent, non-JD auditors, and JD is the degree that U.S. Attorneys tend to have, which is Juris Doctor, who have the power. So the auditors have the power to challenge them, including real time. So that's my wish and hope. Now, if that never happens, which in the highly political climate of the US, it might not, then maybe someday soon there will be a, ChatGPT type AI program that can take the place of our less than humanistic judges. We'll have to see about that. So my interest in documentary evidence has, continue to grow based on my experiences and those of other whistleblowers and litigants who've contacted me over the years. So I'm now involved in a project with a nonprofit in which we want to get complete court records of cases from litigants who have felt cheated and mistreated. So we'll be creating a database to mine for issues of case merit and harms to the litigants. And I can sort of tell, lots of probably potential listeners of yours are going to have their ears prick up hearing that. That sounds good. Right. So it's previously been very difficult to do this sort of work given the major manpower that was needed and therefore the cost involved. But recently, there have been advances in artificial intelligence or AI that could make this much more manageable. So there are already AI-based investigative and e-discovery programs. E-discovery means electronic discovery. That's the kind of thing attorneys would use that exist in which you can do data mining. And by the way, any listener who has practical experience in legal informatics, in particular using AI, is welcome to join us by contacting me. You should be able to find my email address in that menu, that document that should be linked. Similarly, any listener who has a complete case record, as they might have submitted an appeal, should also consider dropping me a line.
Oh, I
And by
will.
the way, oh yeah, right. So yeah, thank you. So we're already off to the races. By the way, it's likely that we'll anonymize the data sets, at least as far as the litigants and their what we call PII, personally identifiable information. So you don't have to be too worried. We can't guarantee it, but we're gonna try that. We'll see how the AI, some of these AI programs will do that as well. So as I said, I think my cases have many elements of judicial and attorney misconduct in parallel to your case and the cases of prior guests that I've listened to. In addition to judges strong arming and defaming the litigants and attorneys throwing their clients under the bus to preserve their business in front of problem judges, we've got some additional abuses that I've experienced and heard about from others on your show. Take, for instance, judicial failures to disclose conflicts of interest and then recuse or disqualify. Right? You've heard that story before.
Oh, yes.
There were several bases of concern in my case for bias, with the most blatant being that the judge in the family law case, now this is a different judge than the one I was talking about before. It's not the federal judge. This is a local family law judge, has a cousin in the same city as the litigation, who is also a judge and who in turn had an extended association with the opposing party. That is to say, my now ex-wife. But in Pennsylvania, as in many, if not too many, U.S. jurisdictions, the fraud of self-regulation, which is what I consider what these our judicial system's doing, allows the potentially conflicted judge to decide for him or herself if they wish to recuse. And guess who didn't recuse in my case? Right. Okay. So that's this is
Same.
something you've heard a lot about, right? So if someone wants to look into the gory details, they're kind of interesting, and there's a big laundry list beyond what I just mentioned that went on in my case. But I want to move on to something that I think is also pretty important, which is a lot of due process violations, and they just never seem to end. And it's a very common abuse, and in fact, the list of pardon me, due process violations in my case is so extensive that I had to wonder if any of these judges, and also involves a master, had actually attended law school, or if they did, whether they got a passing grade in this topic. But in reality, more likely, it's the type of personalities that are getting into these positions, that's the problem. They really simply do not care. So I know you've done some interesting things on, psychology in the past, or at least in your books. I don't remember the program. But take sociopaths and psychopaths in particular. We know they're violators of the rules and rights of others. But also, and I want to point this out, also in common with other people with what we call high D factor personality disorders, they're domineering. So in their domain, they are the boss. And in their minds, they make the rules. So in one of my links, I have an excerpt that I provide, where I provide a list of procedural due process rights, as well as some quoted case law. And I think these rights are so important that they should be further specified and taught to all school children. That's how important I found them during my journey through these court
Agreed.
cases. Right? Yeah, because that's where we need to learn that really early. Everyone needs to know that. Because the problem is you're already behind the eight ball. You end up in one of these courts, like a family court, or God forbid, you're a whistleblower, and suddenly you're this little, David up against Goliath, and you're learning on the run, on the fly, and it's a little late. So it's better to know up front what's right and what's wrong. So I'm going to read through one list I have in my linked excerpts because it really bears repeating. So this particular list I found, which is why I'm pointing now, because I think, the listeners and viewers will really, if they're involved in a case or they've had one, they might want to look this one up because it's really, I think, comprehensive and well written. And it was written by a Judge Henry J. Friendly of the United States Court of Appeals, Second Circuit. He was a very famous jurist, and I think the current Supreme Court Justice Roberts worked or clerked for him. So Judge Friendly produced this list of basic due process rights which apply equally to civil and criminal proceedings. And they are as follows. Number one, you have a right to an unbiased tribunal. Very hard. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably didn't get past first base, right? Number two, you deserve a notice. It's a right to get a notice of the proposed action and the grounds asserted for it. Third, you have an opportunity to present the reasons why the proposed action should not be taken. You have a right to present evidence, including the right to call witnesses. You have a right to know opposing evidence. You have a right to cross-examine adverse witnesses. And you have a right to a decision that's based exclusively on the evidence presented. And we'll hear about some of these problems in a moment what I experienced. You have an opportunity to be represented by counsel, as we just mentioned, that may start out that way, but it often doesn't. It may not work out for the duration. There's a requirement that the tribunal prepare a record of the evidence presented. And I should add to that, he might, if we want to upgrade this someday, it's got to be a non-falsified record, because there's a lot of cases where we're hearing, like, not that one person that I helped investigate, but there's a lot of cases, including mine, where you're getting people in the, you know, manipulating the court record in one way or the other, usually the judges, masters, people in the clerks or court reporters. All of these people can manipulate these records, and it's very troubling to the litigants. Finally, there's a requirement that the tribunal prepare written findings of fact and reasons for its decision. Okay, so I think it's an interesting list. You can find it again in the links. In my family law case, this is my little quickie list of some of the things that happened that I felt were serious due process violations. Like, for example, my property rights were unilaterally taken without hearing by the trial court. Fees for purported contempt were issued without hearing based on what I had appealed as errors of law by the master. And by the way, in Pennsylvania, you don't necessarily, in a family law case, directly go, let's say a divorce, you don't directly have a, you know, case presented to a judge. They have an attorney who's called a master, who hears the facts of the case first and comes up with what's called a report and presents that to the judge. And then you can litigate it further with the judge, the trial judge, who's the family court judge. So in my case, I had funds that were cut off before hearing by the trial court. And then I also had conclusions about credibility of a party, that is to say, myself and the other party, were drawn by this master from impermissible ex parte investigations, which she mislabeled as judicial notice. So I had gone through quite a due process violation grinder. It was quite something. And to give you a little more explanation on this battle over credibility, because it can be important, right? Because, you know, you often end up with he said, she said. I wrote to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that about this master, you know, the idea that she can make her own observations to contribute to testimony concerning credibility. And here she, you know, these people are just saying the way he sounds, the way she looks, you know, makes me think they're more believable. Well, that's problematic. And I'll go into what kind of research has been done on that. So that's number one. But this lady went further. She went out and did what's called an ex parte investigation, meaning on her own, she went out and started looking up things that she could find out about the parties. And that can lead to also significant questions of whether there was an impartial tribunal has been afforded a litigant. So current law in Pennsylvania is based upon the belief that an adjudicator, like the master in my family law case, should be able to use her untrained, and I argue extremely biased, eye to decide that the way that I sounded or that the way the other party looked or that I looked was not as credible as, say, for instance, my ex-spouse. What I pointed out to the Supreme Court was that even were the master a credible reporter, the premise of, and this is based on case law we call Carney. It's a particular piece of case law. There are others, but this is the one they usually, the appellate court seem to cite, called Carney. It seems to be that any court official, even one not explicitly qualified as an expert, can assess truthfulness from demeanor. However, right? I mean, you know, and that's it. However, this view has been studied scientifically, and it's been presented in law reviews, and it's been found unwarranted. And so I quoted this to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. I said, a premise, this is now from a law review that's reviewing scientific studies on this issue of, can you really have a judge or a master sort of just look at someone who's testifying and decide whether they're credible or not? And this is what they found. They said that a premise of several legal rules and institutions is that the opportunity of a trier of fact, which can also include a jury, a judge, or a hearing officer, to view the demeanor of a witness is of great value to the trier in deciding whether to believe the witness's testimony. However, with impressive consistency, the experimental results indicate that this legal premise is erroneous. On the contrary, there is some evidence that the observation of demeanor diminishes rather than enhances the accuracy of credibility judgments. So that's what they wrote. And it's very much what we see. You know, sometimes as, when you're trained as a fraud examiner or a fraud investigator, the innocent people can be kind of very energized because they're upset. They feel like they're being accused. They can really behave. And yet the guilty parties or the liable parties, they can be cool as cucumbers, cool as ice. They're just completely coming across like a well-spoken you know, narrator. So you have to be very careful when you do these things. So in my case, though, the master made these claims about credibility of the parties, even though, as I wrote to the state Supreme Court, it seems very difficult to understand how the party that was continually found to be making mistakes, quote unquote mistakes, was deemed to be the more credible one. For example, it took 6 months and thousands of dollars of expenditures by me to hire additional legal counsel in order to get now ex-wife to admit she had not reported literally almost seven figures of retirement accounts to the court. Now, that's actually a crime in Pennsylvania. But of course, the master, whom I came to, and I'm just kind of joking here, affectionately referred to my exes as cousin, her cousin Conley, took all of this as just another boo-boo. The master did this in the context of shutting down my motion to extend discovery. You know, it's crazy. So now my ex-wife and her counsel's purported mistakes were not limited just to this retirement account issue, which was a huge amount of money. They also involved failure to disclose a pension, resistance to acknowledging a duplicate insurance payment in the manner of a prepayment fraud, claiming that a finance car had been leased, and failing to report 1099 INTs, which are these interest things you can, that the IRS, that you report to the IRS. We also asked to have them provided in discovery. As I said, the master wouldn't allow that. But when you have a biased tribunal, and the tribunal, by the way, can be the master, the judge, literally any adjudicator, all of this evidence can just gets characterized as innocent mistakes, right? You can't win because everything you do when you're caught, if it's going to be a mistake, you're untouchable. So what the master gathered from this one opinion published on the internet in an entirely different case, now that's that earlier federal case I was in that involved me somehow, that provided information to her about my credibility. So this is the biggest of all the stories that have with the due process. So what this master was actually doing was not taking judicial notice, as she claimed. So what taking judicial notice is something that's quite restricted, actually. It has to be indisputable information. For example, a judge, I believe, could take judicial notice that there was an intersection at 60th Street and Broadway in New York City, let's say on, you know, in such and such an era. Instead, what this master was doing, her own judicial investigation, which means she went on her own and went out and started looking up stuff on the internet about one of the parties. That's not permitted, and certainly not without hearing from the party, such as myself, before coming to a judgment. So she just started. She literally put 1,200 words into her master's report about what she thought she found in this opinion published online. And so... and she actually wrote that she therefore found it made me look less credible. So in trying to draw inferences from other legal cases, due process would have required the master to give me a chance to respond and present evidence to potentially correct her. As it turned out, she did not know what she was talking about since she had no real knowledge of the case or the hundreds of other filings in it. So that's not just a problem restricted to one master. The federal judge in that earlier case had also done his own self-serving investigation when I and my attorneys challenged what, or yeah, my attorney's challenge, why the court reporter records had disappeared for some of the hearings in the case. We appealed that to the Third Circuit of Appeals, and after they simply turned a blind eye to the misconduct, we appealed it to the Supreme Court of the United States, and which didn't take the case. But I have our Supreme Court filing on the web. Now, it's not in these listed documents, but I do have it somewhere else on the web. And, you know, so people can, it's because I think it's important to understand how our public records access laws are not being respected and what this says about how litigation is being handled by the courts. So, sorry, I went away. You know, at the end of the day, the evidence of record is one of the most important things that we have to protect ourselves. You know, in the family law case, the master claimed that I had admitted, she used that word, some important knowledge of finances, which now ex-wife had failed to disclose. Of course, that too ended up in appeals, which went like this at the Supreme Court level. excuse me, the Superior Court level. Now, the Superior Court is actually an intermediate appellate court in Pennsylvania below the top Supreme Court. So you go from your family court, which is a trial court, up to a Superior Court, and then that can go up to the Supreme Court if they even list want to take your case. Superior Court has to listen to your case. So I said to them on a, and this is what they wrote. So they heard about this, what the master did, and this is what they wrote. They said, on appeal, husband challenges the master's statements that the husband testified he oversaw the party's investment to a very detailed and exhaustive knowledge of the party's finances, and that, quote, by his own admission, husband was largely in charge of the party's finances. No relief is due. So she was trying to dig, this was another thing. So ex-wife, so she's trying to say, even if she did hide this information, all this information, you would have known about it because you knew everything. And I denied that. And so no relief is due, they said. We reiterate that a master's report and recommendation is to be given the fullest consideration, particularly on the question of credibility of witnesses, which I've already discussed, because the master has the opportunity to observe and assess the behavior and demeanor of the parties. That's Carney. So they're just reiterating what I just went through about Carney, this case law in Pennsylvania. And then they said the points raised by husband relate to one isolated issue, the extent of husband's knowledge of wife's finances, the weight of which would not require reversal of the master's and the trial court's extensive findings into other matters presented in this case. So this is why they're not going to do anything for me. But as I noted in my first filing to the state Supreme Court after they said that, or they wrote that, even if it had been only one such issue, what the master seems to have done is repeatedly fabricated a false admission. So I believe that's a very serious charge and shouldn't be lightly dismissed. It's as if the master had been handling, no, so if the master had been handling a criminal case, let's say, and she were found to have been involved in fabricating false confessions, it's highly likely that such behavior would have been a major factor going towards reversing the extensive findings she had made, particularly since the credibility of those were challenged as evidentiarily flawed as well. So it's also worth considering what the Superior Court's concession regarding the master's repeated false claims says about the master and her credibility. Okay, so despite their attempt to minimize the importance of this finding, were the master not their colleague, it might be easy to imagine that the courts would consider such behavior to be highly impeaching, right? If you found out that I was falsely claiming that another party had admitted to so and so, I don't think any of these judges would have looked upon that very favorably, and they wouldn't have minimized that. They would have thought, "Oh, this guy's a complete lie. You know, we can't. He's untrustworthy at the very least, right?" That's what I think would have happened. So that's impeaching. So I concluded to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania that, despite the fact that I seemingly prevailed on this point with the Superior Court, the reason that it happened, that they actually acknowledged it on this one point, probably she, I didn't say what she said. I said. And the reason that happened is important, I think, for the listeners here, because it's going to get to the final, to the point of what we're trying to do with this new artificial intelligence, which is what I did was, at the advice of one of my attorneys, he's a very skilled appellate litigator, I presented a complete case record to the appellate court. So you're going to present some records, and in Pennsylvania, you can produce selective records you're going to talk about, or, and he persuaded me, and I was already going to do it anyway, because I also lean that way. I took the whole shebang, everything that had been in the case, everything they said, we said, we filed the evidence, everything, and put it up in searchable form like a PDF. And I also provided, that was kind of key, I think, several search terms that I had used to mine that complete record, the case record, for information relevant to what I claimed, such as about admission. So I had a list of search terms where I said, you know, admit, admitted, you know, and all the stuff that I did, so that anyone could go to the complete record and say, did this man say anything about admitting anything? And so it turns out that although the appellate courts conceded nothing else to me, this master went on to have her power circumscribed. Her position as a master was put directly under the supervision of another court attorney, which I took to be a demotion. That's really all they gave me. They said, okay, you know, to overall, anyway, my court experience has led me to recommend to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that they could take some concrete steps to reduce the risk of these problematic handling of evidence in decisions by their court officers. Court officers, by the way, include judges, magistrates, but also the attorneys and other court officials. So, number one, they should overrule this Pennsylvania case law called Carney and anything related to it, and prevent completely any introduction of observational conclusions by adjudicators that are not based on sound expert foundations and due process. So, if you're going to say to someone, you're going to conclude and write a conclusion saying, I didn't think the guy sounded credible. And there's a very interesting story behind that if we have time. But anyway, you have to give us a chance to respond. That's due process. Number two, set a non-discretionary requirement for counsel and adjudicators to quote the complete record equally for both parties. Because I think when they sit there and they're typing their reports or their opinions and they're kind of remembering things and they're paraphrasing, it can really go out the window. It can become a mess. So if you, and this is what I try to teach when I teach biology to the college students, I always tell them, I know when you were a kid, they probably didn't want you to quote as much. I don't know what that is nowadays, but it was true for us. They always wanted you to take whatever you read and you paraphrase it. And I said, forget about it. It's going to be easier. You paste, you quote. I'm going to judge you based on the quality of what you're quoting and how you think about it and your conclusion. But for judges and adjudicator, other adjudicators like a master, if you quote all the parties, everybody can see and review exactly what was said, and you're going to make fewer mistakes in your paraphrasing. So also number three and last, it's require the master in the courts at all levels to provide the search terms used to assess the current complete record for each point of evidence addressed. So I think by presenting a list of search terms, which they use to assess a complete record, litigants in the public could be better able to confirm that the courts effectively read the material presented to them by the parties. And that could reduce the overlooking and misapprehensions of evidence. That's the way the courts call it, overlooking and misapprehensions of evidence that could be taking up the time of the appellate courts. So, we hear that. I hear this all the time. Litigants, people complaining, they were cheated in their case. And one of the things they'll say is, I could tell the court, the judges never read what I wrote. I get it all the time. No, I did not read what I wrote because they say this and it's obvious they didn't see, didn't read my filing. So I think this is a way to make it more clear with the quotes and search terms that they have to list them in a judicial opinion or any other filing that everybody's on the same page with what you're saying. What did the parties actually say? And if it's a huge record, how did you search for it? Did you, so that anybody else could reproduce it? So anyway, I was just on the phone about a week ago with a company that's creating software that should allow users to extract quotes made by each party relevant to specific evidence, to merits, harms, etc. And so I pointed out to the company's representative, it was not just auditors like myself and my colleagues who could use these functions, but the actual courts themselves could too. Except for high-level appellate courts like the U.S. Supreme Court, as far as I know, most lower-level trial court judges probably have only a single clerk who helps with their caseload, if they even have a clerk. Okay. I mean, some of them probably work alone. So it seems to me it would be very likely that judges and their clerks are not, in fact, actually reading all of the material, just as so many litigants suspect, even when litigants cite pages in the record. So I provided, as I mentioned, my own search terms to the Pennsylvania Superior Court to hold their feet to the fire, meaning I could, in fact, prove my point with the same search terms and complete record in a way that would satisfy the public. So that was made it harder to dodge that particular file, part of my filing, and it worked in its limited way. It seemed to work anyway. So one of the great benefits of AI is that the user doesn't even have to use sophisticated search terms to try to ensure relevant material was not missed. So you don't have to be a search term expert. Instead, with AI, it has the ability to seemingly understand the search and adjust the terms it uses internally to cover relevant options, which helps avoid missing important material. And so this makes searches of huge legal records much simpler and more effective. So finally, although our AI database work is initially intended for use with so-called whistleblowers, I want to point out to your audience, which I guess is largely involved in family law cases, that whistleblowers are not just informants who provide information to the government and other responsible entities about fraud and misconduct. They're also often complainants which is why they can be retaliated against, including by online and other defamatory court publications, as I mentioned in my case. That's why I urge family court litigants with complaints to consider that they're often in the position of whistleblowers and can suffer similar reprisals and harms. Right? So I think it would be no problem to create a family law database with the intent that we are not only trying to help the injured litigant achieve some justice, but also as a group to help our fellow citizens avoid similar fates by using our collective data to improve the system. So that's what we're up to. Or
I think that's great. I think that's the best news I've heard all day.
Yeah. So, well, we'll see how it works out. I mean, it's early days with artificial intelligence. You know, there's quite a few, I would say, but not more than, you know, in the matter of half dozens of software out there. And it's probably mostly too expensive and doing too many things we don't need. But we're looking at investigative software and even other AI tools to, you know, see if we can actually conduct this project in a credible way for, you know, that we can do.
I think that's great. Something has to be done. Nothing's moving with this family court problem.
Yeah, it's a kind of a do it for them approach because they're not going to do it themselves. They really like self-regulating. They really, and that allows them to not survey for complaints, right? There's no law that says you must get every litigant in these cases to describe their experience and concerns about how they felt in court, right? Lots of companies do that. Organizations that really want to improve do that. But there's no, they don't have to.
But they just won't look at evidence. I don't know. It's a game of who knows who.
Absolutely. That's certainly what the case was. It's a political case. It's all politics is what it was in my cases, both of them, the federal case. And this, it was all about politics and influence. And they're kind of just it's just the gatekeepers there, the judges for that, not the evidence, not merit, not justice, none of those things. That's what we need to change.
Right. And even like in my federal case, the judge admitted to not looking at my evidence. Now, what dope admits to not
admitted it.
Evidence? So I had to file a motion saying, read the evidence, motion to read evidence.
Yeah, it was great. I remember that. That's one of your classic moves, right? I love that. Yeah, I have to. Motion to file evidence, right?
Read it. Just read it. And so probably he read it in 2 minutes because it was 1,000 pieces of evidence, a case with merit that should have been taken seriously. And as you know, the opposing attorney that was representing the bad actors had hauled me into a boardroom and said, look, I know you've been to court. I can tell you how this case is going to go. I know both those judges in the federal courthouse, and I can tell you pretty much how this case is going to go. I'm going to get this dismissed, and that's pretty much how it's going to go. So I handed him his exhibits and I said, and you have a nice day. Then I went and filed affidavits and I submitted it to all parties. He didn't like that very much.
No. And I, that's because you're really impressive. I mean, you get things done. I'm impressed. But in my case, yeah, I heard the same kind of statements. Because the lawyers know. They know these judges, right? This is part of their business. The judge is part of their business. So they know, they say the same things to people like me. Mine is a little more troubling because I think in the family law case, I had a judge initially where one of the attorneys advising me, he said, oh, this guy is, you know, had an experience like yours with his spouse. And I think it's great. We're going to get this judge. But guess what? At the last minute, all of a sudden he doesn't take the case. And this other guy comes in who's related to the, you know, the other party. And it's like, oh, wow. You know, now that, you know, they'll claim, oh, that's just kind of scheduling thing or this or that. But, you know, who the judge is makes a big difference. Huge difference, right? So, you know, it was a concern. I mean, I go into more details again in some of these documents than we probably have time for on the show. So if people are really interested, they can look at it. And as I said, you know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of people are looking for justice in their own cases, if they're listening to this podcast or watching the YouTube. And, you know, like you and I just said, it's not likely that these courts will do it themselves. They're not going to reform themselves. They don't want to. And it's very unlikely, I hate to say this, that it is a political, the courts are part of the political system. And it's very unlikely, therefore, I hate to say this as well, that at least at the federal level, that they're going to get reformed. I remember in Ayn Rand's research, I spent years kind of trying to support federal legislation by some of the most powerful congressmen, senators in the at the federal level, both Democrats and Republicans, who were agreed. So you would think, oh, fantastic. And in this particular case, that was to get a federal office of the inspector general for the judiciary. Yeah, for years. And these are really powerful people. Well, you would think if bipartisan powerful senators and congressmen agree on something, you would have thought, we got this. Not a chance, because judges and lawyers are very powerful themselves. They've got a lot of clout. That stuff died for years. So typically what happens in the American political system is I almost know, well, everyone's from the US probably is listening to this, but is you have to go in at the state level. You learn the lesson, which is the kinds of changes that you can make incrementally. What really happens is, so for example, Colorado was probably one of the first that I know about who people were upset in Colorado at what was going on in the courts. Their legislature did pass a audit bill where the courts are being audited and people can submit complaints. Then eventually other states like New York and I think Florida did start their own state level inspector general, judiciary, not quite as powerful as it really should be. Even the federal legislation wasn't as powerful as it should be, but you got to start somewhere. So anyway, these things are slowly spreading through the states. And eventually what you find is that if enough states pass these things, it'll then potentially pass at the federal level. So that's kind of the way things go. So it's very slow, and that slowness is part of the pain for you're suffering this pain.
Yes.
And these processes can take years, if not decades. So that's why we're hoping some of these artificial intelligence approaches with the new technology can empower us to get a lot more of this data processed. Again, that do it for them approach, where the citizens can just get this technology and say, hey, we in conjunction with some professional auditors, we've looked at this stuff, look at these problems. We think we should pass some legislation quicker.
Yeah, there's too many people suffering. Cases that have gone on, and they'll go to litigate it. Then they'll say, "Well, you're past your statutes of limitation," even though we all know that's not true.
Oh, that's another one. Yeah, statute of limitations. In fact, that's what the Department of Justice was writing about when they wrote an amicus brief in my case at the federal level. This judge immediately knew, oh, we'll just shut it down with statute of limitations. He was like 90% of the case is right out the door because he was claiming, oh, the statute of limitations just starts when the grants start. That's the thing and not the progress. It was all detailed about the progress reports. And no, the Department of Justice is saying, no, every time you cut a check, every payment is starting the statute of limitations again. If you have committed fraud in what you filed, and you keep accepting a check. Every time you accept a check from the United States government, you're committing taxpayer fraud, fraud against the taxpayer. This judge didn't buy it at all. So they wrote an amicus brief. And again, this is what I was referring to. The Department of Justice said, well, we want you to file, but my attorneys wouldn't do it. And I had no pro se abilities at that time. I couldn't, I didn't know what to do. I had no idea. I hadn't gone to be trained as a paralegal. And that was it. They didn't want to, their attitude was, look, we're going to file this. Yes, it may get overturned. And guess what? This same judge is going to be our judge again. And we only live one life. We just don't have the time to see this fellow again. Again, in effect, in that kind of a case, contingency case, they're paying for it because as a relator, as a federal false claims or QUITAM Act type person, you don't actually have to pay to do that work. The attorneys do it because, and the reason they do it is they expect a big jackpot payoff. So we were expecting millions of dollars back because we thought, oh, I had every law firm in this country want to take my case because it was a positive control case. These people were very well known to be, having thought anyway to be committed fraud in around the world. So the scientists, it was a very well-known case, kind of a positive control, we'd call it in science. So everybody wanted to take my case. And no attorneys, law firms thought there was a statute of limitations problem. But the judge came up with that. So yeah, statute of limitations is one of those, things they use, one of those little hand grenades they throw to take out a case. Yeah.
I'm so glad you came onto this podcast. This was amazing. And
was fun.
we'll do
Kind
it again. I'd like to have you back.
of venting. Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, so I thank you very much for this nice opportunity. Now, we have spoken before, but to be on your show is great. I love your show.
Oh, thank
It's
you.
obvious that people and your books, you're a great writer. I don't even know. In fact, I have to learn from you. You have to do show. How do you do all that you do? Like, I would love
Don't
all the time. How does she write all these books and do all these shows? And it's like, do you ever sleep? I mean, I don't know how you're doing all this stuff.
know. Well, day by day, I'm working on my fourth book, and that's taking some time. So I just work on it day by day. And I have to put limits on myself is when I rest and go lay on the couch. So I'm napping and then sleeping at night at least. But you have to take care of yourself through all of this, helping people, talking to people on the phone. It's just so sad what the American people are being put through by these
It is
state courts
terrible.
and these low-life family court judges.
It is amazing. It is amazing. So, yeah, it is horrific.
Yeah.
And it is so abusive. Yeah, I don't even want to say you. So anyway, that was just an overview. I didn't even touch on everything, but you're absolutely right. I can second that opinion very strongly. And again, we're doing our part, I hope, with this other group. And we can try to get some tools together where we can try to facilitate getting this corrected and improved more quickly than otherwise the process I described would be, where it's going to take years and decades to finally pass something. So see what we can
Wow,
do.
that's awesome. Well, hey, I still want to have you back on, but I'll put all your
I
contact
look forward to it.
information. Yeah, I'll put all your contact information in the podcast notes. So don't jump off. Slam the Gavel is a podcast to help the public understand what really goes on in these family courtrooms. I'm your host, Marianne Petry, author of Dismantling Family Court Corruption, Why Taking the Kids Was Not Enough, and Cry Out for Justice, Poems of Truth, and Raised by These Wolves, How Family and Federal Courts Are Failing Our Children. You can find me on Spotify, YouTube, Apple iTunes, Anchor FM, iHeartRadio, and other platforms I don't know about. And please feel free to buy me a coffee to help keep this podcast going. You can find that in the podcast notes. Thank you so much, Dr. Boschwitz.
Thank you. Thank you, man, for having me on.